Welcome to Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Just ahead on today's program, we hear what the latest State of the Air report from the American Lung Association says about air quality and pollution in Louisiana's largest cities. Also, 14 years after the Deepwater Horizon disaster, how the critically endangered Rice's Well is coping. But first, all week, we're hearing from public school teachers in Louisiana about how they're feeling as costs rise and wages stagnate. Yesterday, we heard from a 23-year-old who's thinking of leaving the profession after only a year in the classroom because of low pay.
It gives me a sense of urgency. Like, I feel like I need to make more because what if I have, like, an emergency?
Education reporter Aubrey Juhas joins me now. Hello, Aubrey.
Hi, Adam.
So who are we hearing from today?
Today we're hearing from a teacher who's been on the job for nearly two decades. She's been working in Jefferson Parish since 2018, and she makes $58,000 a year. And for her, the struggle to make enough money is all about what kind of life she can provide for her daughter. Here's Lauren Luby.
My name's Lauren Luby, and I teach fifth grade math. This is my 18th year, and I've taught in three separate parishes. I chose to teach because I like kids. I like seeing them learning new things. I like to be able to be that person for them. And pay was never that forefront. I took a pay cut coming to Jefferson Parish, but my daughter was 2 years old and they were redistricting some things, so I was going to have to drive farther. So I went ahead and I took that pay cut to be able to be closer to home so she could do after school activities and that, those things. And I haven't really gotten a pay raise since I've been in Jefferson Parish. After about a year, I started to kind of see that I wasn't making enough. So last year I did tutoring. Two summers ago, I worked for a friend of the family's, his insurance agency, and did paperwork and different things for him to make extra money during the summer so that I could have kind of that nest egg and that extra money to be able to do things for my daughter and not worry so much about money. You really do have to work at home, and they give us 45 minutes, but by the time your kids get out of your classroom, they get where they need to be for PE or wherever they're going for your planning time, you have time to use the bathroom, run copies, make phone calls if you need to make phone calls, emails. There's not, that 45 minutes isn't enough planning time to actually effectively plan what you need to plan. So I get up early and do some work in the morning before I go to school. And then I'll do work at night to go ahead and be ready for tomorrow. If I got paid for all the extra time that I worked and not just the 7 to 3, then it would be easier to digest. But I'm not getting paid for all the time that I'm spending doing my job. This field is a mess right now. New teachers are coming in and it's not the dream that they thought it was gonna be, and they're out. And you're like, I can make more money working at Starbucks and hand people coffees and smile all day long. Last year I had a very difficult group of kids and it was a lot. And I did research other jobs. I was having high blood pressure and being stressed all the time. And my new school is so much better. And I have such a good group of kids this year that I find myself really going back and enjoying my job more. So then making less money or having to work other jobs to make money doesn't seem as daunting.
That was Lauren Luby. She's just one of dozens of teachers I've heard from about the challenges they face due to low pay. And tomorrow, I have a few more voices from New Orleans and the latest on where things stand politically.
Okay, we'll look forward to it. Thanks, Aubrey.
You're welcome.
From WRKF and WWNO, this is Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. In 2021, ecologists discovered that a group of whales residing exclusively in the Gulf of Mexico was a unique species of whale. The Rice's whale is now considered to be critically endangered, with a population possibly well under 100 individuals. As we observe this past week, the 14th anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon incident and the subsequent oil spill, ecologists are concerned how that environmental catastrophe affected this population of whales, and they're working on further protective measures. Dan Moss is a senior government relations representative with Defenders of Wildlife and is heavily involved in these conservation efforts. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate it.
So a couple of years ago, we shared with our listeners how the Rice's whale was reclassified as its own species and that its conservation situation is very much in peril. Could you remind us, what's the background here?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, it was reclassified as its own species back in, as you noted, back in 2021. But in fact, scientists had long suspected that this species known as Brutus whale actually turned out to be Rice's whale, but they had suspected this was a different species. And ironically enough, in part because of the Deepwater Horizon spill, additional federal resources came into the Gulf, and the government was able to do research which proved genetic testing, which certainly showed, indicated that we were talking about a new species. That happened in 2014, but they needed additional confirmation of that, which they received back in 2019 when a Rice's whale was found washed up on a beach. In good condition, and they were able to do additional testing. And so the combination of those things over years definitively concluded that all led up to the 2021 reclassification.
So how did all these resources make a difference? How has the situation changed since the Rice's whale was first discovered to be its own species?
Well, again, I think it's critically important to note that we are talking about one of the most critically endangered species on the planet. No more than 100 whales, certainly, and the best estimate suggests it's much closer to 50 remaining on the planet. It's also incredibly important to note that scientists estimate that the Deepwater Horizon spill, apart from resulting in the loss of tens of thousands of sea turtles and marine life, dolphins, birds, across the ecological spectrum. In addition to that, scientists estimate that the Deepwater Horizon itself specifically is responsible for the loss of 22% of this species, more than one-fifth. And that's just, obviously, that's just catastrophic. And for those of us who work in wildlife conservation, it's devastating.
What efforts are underway now to protect the whale?
Well, we're pursuing a critical habitat designation. NOAA, the government agency that sort of will oversee some of these protections, is working on finalizing a rule to establish a critical habitat designation for the Rice's whale. And essentially what that'll do would increase attention and resources to the habitat that is most critical to the whale's survival. Initially, for a long time, the whale was presumed to reside fairly exclusively within a sort of a narrow area called DeSoto Canyon. But what we found over the years through extensive monitoring, the whale actually has been seen and spotted and detected across the continental shelf, from across the Florida Panhandle as far west as off the coast of Texas. So its known habitat is much more extensive than we thought for some time.
We're speaking with Dan Moss. He's with Defenders of Wildlife. He's involved in the effort to protect the Rice's whale, a species of whale that resides in the Gulf of Mexico and is critically endangered. Now, you noted how people learned a little bit more about the range of this whale, where it lives. Is that sort of good news, discovering that the whale isn't just in one small geographic location, albeit still restricted to the Gulf of Mexico?
I would say it's just news that the whale is present, and it also calls attention to the kind of measures we need to protect the whale. In the Gulf itself, obviously, since Deepwater Horizon, the government has worked to improve well control standards. The Trump administration subsequently weakened those standards, and the Biden administration largely sought to reinstate those rules. But even improved well control regulations are not going to be sufficient. We note that there are oil spills tiny though some may be, every single day in the Gulf, and the accumulation of the pollutants and the chemicals in the water to these animals is devastating, is crushing. So the fact that they've been spotted in a broader habitat is just suggestive of the fact that we need to do more across a broader area to conserve these species.
And you're mentioning where the whale is observed, their efforts to find them, to observe them. When was an individual of the species last observed? How often do we make contact to confirm that they're still doing okay?
Well, I will note that visual detections are rare by comparison, in part because of the sheer scarcity of the number of whales. We're talking about, you know, close to 50 whales in a wide swath of the Gulf of Mexico. So it's going to be harder to spot these whales visually. But I would say they have been detected regularly by audio means. In fact, by certain monitors that are placed around parts of the Gulf, thousands of times. And so that's the best way and the most frequent way that we have detections of where these animals are. The Rice's whale has a very distinctive audio call that makes it easy to distinguish from other whales.
That's interesting to learn. Has anything changed since Deepwater Horizon to prevent another incident from knocking out a full 22% of an endangered species like this? 22%, about a fifth, as you mentioned, of the entire, possibly only 100 individuals of the species.
So I would just note, yes, after Deepwater Horizon, the well control standards were improved. The Trump administration weakened those standards. The Biden administration has largely sought to reinstate those standards, but we believe that those are not sufficient. Again, we do know that there are oil spills every single day in the Gulf. So in addition to that, we've got ongoing oil and gas development, energy development in the Gulf, which remains an ongoing threat to these whales, to their survival. Another major threat to these whales is our vessel strikes between the sheer amount of commercial traffic in the Gulf and the traffic involved in oil and gas and energy infrastructure in the Gulf. Vessel strikes are lethal to these whales. And so one thing that Defenders of Wildlife has pursued, we petitioned the government to pursue vessel speed restrictions in the Gulf of Mexico. Unfortunately, the government denied that petition. They want to conduct a species recovery plan first before they look into potentially imposing new speed restrictions. But that's one measure we believe certainly would help to reduce the risk of one major threat to this species. It's also, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that as we approach Earth Day, and the theme of Earth Day's theme this year of plastics on the planet, that's all tied hand in hand to some of the threats, whether it's oil, whether it's plastic and debris in the ocean that these whales face, that we're trying to raise awareness of and bring attention to. And one last point, if I may. Mm-hmm. On the public awareness front, I would note that there is a Gulf Coast Whale Festival scheduled for April 27th in Pensacola Beach in Florida, which will again hopefully draw needed attention and interest in this species.
Dan Moss with Defenders of the Wildlife, thanks for being on the program.
Adam, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
From WRKF and WWNO, this is Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. The American Lung Association today released its annual State of the Air Report. It takes a look at air quality and how it affects health and ranks metro areas nationwide to help us learn what the air looks like in southeast Louisiana, including in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. We have with us Eric Weinzettel with the American Lung Association. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
So, in short, how is Louisiana doing as air quality is concerned?
Well, like in a lot of areas, Louisiana has a lot of work to do. We're pretty comparable with the rest of our southeast neighbors, but doing on the lower end of things when it comes to the nationwide metrics. But that's not all doom and gloom. There is some good news, but it varies around the state.
So tell us about Baton Rouge and New Orleans in particular. How are the cities comparing?
Absolutely. So just a bit of background. So the State of the Air Report grades exposure to unhealthy levels of the ground level ozone air pollution, more commonly known as smog, and also annual particle pollution, also known as soot. And then it also measures the short-term spikes in particle pollution. This is over a three-year period. So this report includes air quality data from 2020 to 2022. And it was updated to reflect the new annual particle pollution standard that the EPA finalized in February. But at a glance, it's kind of the tale of two cities. Unfortunately, Baton Rouge's air quality got worse since last year's report and has actually become the worst in the Southeast, whereas New Orleans continues to rank among the cleanest cities in the nation, specifically for particle pollution.
And tell me about that decision to use ozone and particle pollution. What are those and how do they affect health?
Yeah, absolutely. So ground-level ozone pollution and particle pollution are two of the most widespread and dangerous air pollutants. Breathing these pollutants can cause asthma attacks, respiratory and cardiovascular harm, including heart attack and stroke, and even early death. And breathing particle pollution can also cause lung cancer. And the impacts of the air pollutions are especially harmful to people with lung disease, such as asthma and COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, as well as to children, the elderly, and pregnant individuals.
Your report looks not just at air quality city by city and comparing them nationwide. It also asks exactly who it is who is most vulnerable within those cities. In addition to what you just mentioned about people with certain respiratory diseases, who is that?
Well, one of the key things that we look at and is especially prevalent here in Louisiana is that the disparity in exposure to air pollution is along racial and ethnic lines, and it continues to be a serious concern. Although people of color are about 42% of the overall population of the U.S., they're 52% of the people living in parishes or counties with at least one failing grade. And in counties with the worst air quality that gets failing grades for all three measures, people of color are more than twice as likely as white people to be affected.
Seeing that the air has worsened in Baton Rouge, what are the long-term health impacts of breathing unhealthy air? And are there ways that you can counteract that?
Well, the long-term effects are clear. There is the immediate response you might get to increased ozone pollution or particle pollution. But long-term effects we can see pretty clearly in lung disease, lung cancer, and increased cardiovascular risk. And what you can do is to limit yourself as much as possible from air pollution. So you want to pay attention to your daily air quality and take precautions if the air quality is poor. A way to do that is to check airnow.gov. And if the air quality is poor that day, some simple steps you can take is rolling up your car windows, limiting your exercising outside, putting your air conditioners on recirculate, and taking even stricter precautions when you have children or people with existing lung disease. And kind of most prevalent, as we saw in Louisiana last year with those kind of unprecedented wildfires, if you're experiencing wildfire smoke, you can visit lung.org/wildfire for additional information on how to protect yourself.
We're speaking with Eric Weinsettle, the Louisiana Director of Advocacy and Policy for the American Lung Association. We're talking about their State of the Air report, which came out today. You mentioned earlier this being a tale of two cities between Baton Rouge and then New Orleans, where the air quality might actually be improving. Are there any bright spots in your report, and what does that mean for the average Louisiana resident?
Some bright spots to look at. New Orleans continues to rank among the cleanest cities in the nation, which is something we don't often get to tout for Louisiana. They were 98th most polluted in the ozone pollution, which gives them a B grade, which sounds like a lot, but it measures over 200 metro areas is considered in the report. For the year-round particle pollution, New Orleans was 118th most polluted, which got its passing grade. And for the short-term particle pollution, it received an A grade, which it maintained from last year's A grade as well.
I see. Finally, what action can you recommend on the public policy level to improve our air quality? What do you recommend? What's the big idea?
So what we're hoping the people of Louisiana will do is to urge the EPA to take more action. You know, although we talk a lot about the worst in this report, keep in mind that if you look at the change over time, as we have in the 25-year history of the state of the air, you can clearly see that the Clean Air Act is working and we want to urge the EPA to do more. So we're urging the EPA to set long overdue stronger national limits on ozone pollution, because stronger limits would help people protect themselves and drive cleanup of polluting sources across the country.
From a public policy standpoint, do you think there's more that we can do on the federal level or on the state and local level?
I think it has to start at the federal level. EPA has kind of the most widespread control over this, and they are on a track record of posting some final rules that are very promising. But of course, healthy air is something we need to consider at the state and local level. Of course, one of the things we like to say here that kind of helped me really focus in on healthy air as a policy is that the Lung Association won't stop until everyone is breathing healthy air, because when you can't breathe, nothing else matters.
Eric Weinzettel is the Louisiana Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the American Lung Association. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Adam.
And before we go, we'll check on the latest news from the WRKF WWNO newsroom. The Louisiana Republican Party has a new executive director. Karen Henderson has this report.
Corey Dennis, the former manager for Jeff Landry's gubernatorial campaign, has been appointed to the position. He's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. Dennis is a Black Republican, but says he doesn't think that factored into the decision to hire him.
Yeah, I don't think that's why they asked him to be the executive director. I like to think it's because I have a proven record of winning conservative races and supporting conservative candidates and being successful in those endeavors.
Dennis says the goal is to build on the party's recent successes.
We want to keep reaching out to voters and letting them know that we're here, that we're growing.
Louisiana GOP Chairman Derek Babcock says Dennis is a part of a dynamic team of leaders being assembled to bring more historic victories to the Republican Party in the years ahead. He replaces Grant Sheringa, who has moved to Attorney General Liz Morrell's office as a legislative liaison. In Baton Rouge, I'm Karen Henderson.
New estimates from the St. Tammany Parish government show nearly 700 homes and more than 50 businesses were damaged in the tornadoes that ravaged the area around Slidell and Pearl River 2 weeks ago. That's according to Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate reports. National Weather Service assessments of the damage at one of the worst-hit businesses, Eco Builders, which was nearly destroyed, pegged winds at 120 miles per hour after finding a caved-in roof and bent metal beams. In New Orleans, Grow Dat Youth Farm is holding its own series of public forums on City Park's new master plan, as the Coastal Desk's Eva Tesfai reports. The plan would push out the farm in favor of a new road.
GrowDat says it held a forum to highlight younger, diverse voices in the park's master planning process. City Park Conservancy was invited but did not attend. But during the City Park Improvement Association board meeting that occurred at the same time, the park announced it will postpone its next public meeting. This will give the park time to incorporate feedback it has already collected into the plan. Ava Kreuziger, one of the teenagers working at GrowDat, says she hopes the park will consider the work the farm has done, especially the garden she planted in memoriam of her friend Belle Adelman Cannon, who was killed in a car accident outside of the farm.
I know that City Park wants to nurture diverse voices. I want you to come here and see that that is exactly what GrowDat is doing.
GrowDat says it will share the feedback it collects with City Park if it is willing to listen. In New Orleans, I'm Eva Tesfai.
And that does it for Louisiana Considered on a Wednesday. A thank you to Aubrey Uhas, our education reporter from the WRKF WWNO newsroom, Dan Moss with Defenders of Wildlife, and Eric Weinzettel with the American Lung Association. Our managing producer is Lana Schreiber. Our contributing producers are Matt Bloom and myself, Adam Voss. We receive production and technical support from Garrett Pittman and our assistant producer, Aubrey Purcell. I'm Adam Voss. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Tulane School of Public Health.